to foul it up with her stinky herbs. Of course, Lucia is unhappy. But she's not gonna fight with Johnny, so she boils the herbs in the night. I say, like Chinese people say. Lucia taught me this. But she is trying so hard. I hold my nose. I drink the soup. Then she tells me this is not enough. She says, I have to believe. These days, I don't move so well. I have to sit in a wheelchair. You can imagine how much I fucking hate this. All the time, sitting on my ass. Lucia, she takes me outside. Out on the grass, behind the house. It's November. Minnesota jumps into winter in November. Nothing left on the trees. So we can sit and watch the lake, but I get cold so fast. It's beautiful here, she says. Yes, in December I am supposed to go to Israel, but this year I don't think I'm gonna go. You need coat, I say to her. She has flimsy purple jacket. I have fat, she says, laughing. You need some fat. She's right. I have nothing but bones. When I never am feeling hungry, that's when I know I am really sick. We sit around. She goes inside the house, comes out with blankets. Not the wool blanket from living room, because she says that one is too scratchy. She brings the blankets from the bed. I use puffy down comforter, king size. Why not? She says, you should be comfortable. I say, okay. She sits in Adirondack chair next to me. Covers herself with blanket, too. We sit. We don't say nothing for a while. This is okay for Lucia and me. Gia, she comes too, for a few days, all the way from Switzerland. She hasn't seen Lucia in such a long time. I see the way she is talking to her sister. Suspicious, always trying to figure out if Lucia's okay. And Lucia, I see this. She doesn't want to talk to Gia. Whenever Gia comes into room, she walks out. And this is painful to see. Because when I first meet Lucia, all she talks about is her sister. Gia this, Gia that. Me and Gia. Always cutting hair together in Chinatown. They used to be so close. I ask Lucia, what's going on? She gets angry. She is crying. Says, I wouldn't understand. I say, she is your sister. She is blood. I tell her she is making me sad. She says she is sorry. She doesn't want to make me sad. I say, okay, then don't. Past is past. Let it go. She says, Gia try to control her all the time. Always makes her feel bad. I know. It's about the pills. And I don't like pills. I hate pills too. I always think Lucy is perfect. She just needs time to work things out by herself in her head. Always she keeps things locked inside. And Lucia says, now her hands shake from the pills. And I can see it also. How sometimes her left eye twitches. Why don't you stop? I say. Here is peaceful, calm. You don't need shitty pills that hurt your body. That stuff is like poison. It's not so simple, she says. We watch movies. I like action thrillers. I like Denzel Washington, so we watch Philadelphia and Malcolm X and that movie about the running away subway train. Denzel, he is a good actor. And seeing subway, it makes me miss New York. If I could sit on that wood bench outside the store with Lucia, like old times, watching the beautiful people going by, I think that would be nice. When I first marry Lucia, people wonder, who is this Chinese girl? I say, this is Lucia, and everybody likes Lucia. Wherever she goes, she is friends with everyone. Lucia is like child in this way, without walls. Even here in Minnesota, she goes to pharmacy. Pharmacist knows her now. She meets neighbor with the three nasty wolfhounds. She knows all of them, by name. Ward Dunkel and Batman and Robin and Cape. That Dunkel guy, I see the way he looks at her. He likes the women. But fine, okay, men like to look at women. It works. I like people, too. But I am loud, pushy man with missing arm and thick accent. She is less loud. But she is interested in people, where they are coming from. She listens, asks questions. She doesn't pass judgment, so people, they love Lucia. But then when she gets sick, it's different. She is fighting with me all the time, aggressive, snapping like a turtle. I know this is not Lucia, and I think she first gets sick when we're married because we live in that small room in East Village. It's too much going on there, too much noise, too much crazy everywhere, enough to make anybody sick. Lucia needs quiet sometimes, that's all. Here, it's quiet. I used to go all day without talking. Not like now. With nurses and home health aides coming in to poke me all the time. One nurse named Sandy, she comes to my house. She's not good-looking nurse, like in the movies. She's fat, wearing big flowery tent with matching pants. I tell her, please, Sandy, you come to my house, you can wear whatever you want. You don't need to wear uniform like that. She looks insulted. Next day she comes, she is wearing same tent, you believe it? I am a dying man here, she can respect my wish. Yeah. She comes in the morning, sits on my bed. She says, I know we are family for a long time now. You are like brother to me, and I know you are dying too. But I say this, please, you cannot tell Lucia to stop her pills. Family, we disagree. I tell her it's okay if we disagree. It's my opinion. What, a man can't have opinions? I'm a dying man. I'm gonna shove my opinions inside everybody's asses. You know me. You can't do that, she says. You will harm her. She listens to you. Please don't do that again. Yeah, she has temper. I'm not scared of her, but Lucia, I know she is scared. She won't even talk to me, says Gia. She loves you, I say. Now Gia, she is crying too, shit. How is Stefan, I say. Everything is good in Switzerland? Good? I don't know about good. This is also a surprise to me. I am looking worried for Gia. It's been hard, she says. Fucking marriage, I say. Fucking marriage, she says. How come you never have kids? I ask. She stares at the ceiling for a long time. Always Gia is like this, thinking, thinking. Maybe I'm selfish, she finally says. Then I thank you for coming here. I hate airplanes, she says, but I'd rather see you alive than in a casket. You see now why I love Gia. My daughter. She comes to Minnesota too, Annette. She is always my favorite good girl, working for bank in Jerusalem now, wearing grown-up suits. Daughters and fathers. They don't crash head to head. Daughters, they crash with their mothers. But this time she comes in, she says, why do you stay in this cold, dark place? Why are you not coming back to Israel? There is your home, there is your family. Her mother tells her to say to me is ridiculous. I am crazy to die alone in middle of nowhere. I think maybe she is right. But who is to say what is right way to die? We play cards. Gin rummy. Gia wins first few games. I see she's getting embarrassed. Let's play something else, she says. So Johnny teaches us poker game. Takes all our money. I say, give me a break. You're gonna get everything I have soon enough. This is joke, but you know what? Johnny slams his cards on the table, walks away. Aya. Oh, Dad, says Annette. She runs after him. He's just sad, says Lucia. I think how many times in my life I have been stupid like this, making my own son feel bad. And how many more times do I have left to make him feel better again? I am coughing up blood now. I have woman doctor. She says to Lucia, if it soaks a panty liner, you call me. You believe a doctor says something like that? First time I was scared shitless, and I am thinking, those are my insides coming out. But now it's like regular, no big deal, a little blood. But Lucia, I can see she is afraid. One day I puke in toilet and Lucia says we have to call doctor. I say, come on, it's nothing. She says, are you fucking kidding me? She doesn't say the word fucking, but I know it's what she thinks. And she is really mad, so I say, okay. Because what do I know about Mexipad? The doctor says we have to go to the hospital. Emergency room. No fucking way, I say. I'm not going anywhere. I die, I'm dying here. Johnny, for one time in my life, he agrees with me. And Gia, I see she is not wanting to get involved. But Annette and Lucia, they are yelling and screaming and calling me a stubborn fool, a selfish jackass. And then they are both crying. But this time, I don't move. Because I won't die in a fucking hospital. And you know what? There is no more puke. No more blood. And I turn on the TV and watch some game shows. Price is Right, Family Feud. The next day there is no more blood. But I'm in so much pain I can't move. Lucky for me, this is the day I get a delivery. I get a brand new hospital bed. Where should we put it? Says Johnny. Down in the dining room, says Annette. Lots of space. No way, I say, like my bedroom. But you can't move, says Annette. What about the stairs? But they listen to me. They push my king-size bed to the wall. And this room, it's so big I can fit the hospital bed next to it. Two beds. Like a hotel, says Lucia. Perfect, I say. Perfect, she says. And now I am comfortable. I am wanting shakshuka. I say, I want shakshuka. So Lucia and Johnny both make me shakshuka. They are having contests to see who's going to make the best shakshuka, like some reality TV show, and I'm going to be celebrity judge. And then Gia says she's going to make shakshuka too. And she finds a recipe on the internet. Never in my life I've had three people cooking for me, and even though the chemicals, the chemo, mix so I can't taste anything right, I think, this life is pretty good. They try to get along. I see this, the four of them. The next day, I am watching action thriller in my bedroom, and they are in kitchen making so much noise. For first time, I hear Lucia and Gia laughing together. And this makes me happy. But I am also a little bit sad I am not laughing with them. Then they come in and there is Johnny holding crazy big cake with a million candles, like big enough for 50 people. You gonna set my house on fire? Is it my birthday? I say. No, says Anat. My daughter, she is smiling so hard she is squeezing tears out of her eyes. But it's a good day for cake, says Lucia. Tiramisu cake, says Johnny, who is very proud of this cake, that I see now is square-shaped, with brown and white icing like chessboard. Lucy and me, we used to play chess. They are wearing hats on their heads, those triangle party hats, for kids. They start to sing happy birthday song, and I laugh. And then next thing, all these people are coming into my room, one and then the next and then the next. I see there is the doctor, the pharmacist, my friend who owns local hardware store, the neighbor with the free wolfhounds, other neighbors from around the lake. And the nurse with the big tent who is not wearing big tent today. Only bad dress that looks like smoke. Lucy? She knows I hate surprises, but she also knows only stupid fool would be mad about this. Everyone makes small talk. And I look at them and I think these people, most people, are nice. They don't know what to say to me. I know it can be uncomfortable. So I make small talk too. About Denzel Washington. Smoke Lady loves Denzel Washington. And then I fall asleep. And when I wake up, everyone is gone. No cake, no plates, no red plastic cups. Just triangle birthday hat on my head. I know Lucia, she puts it there. She is so small, sleeping alone in my king-size bed. Next day, Gia comes in to say goodbye. Lucia is taking her to airport now, she says. She gives me a kiss on my forehead. I say, no crying. She nods. I love you. She says. She can't look at me. I don't look at her, either. Both of us pretending like we're not gonna crack. But for first time, I feel how real it is. When Lucia comes back, I am eating dinner Johnny made, watching game show on TV. She throws herself down on king-size bed. Everything went okay? I say. I think so, she says. Good. She lets out great big sigh. I don't bother her anymore. I close my eyes. Even dying man needs to know when to shut up. When it's morning, I say, tell me about Ecuador. It's beautiful, she says. We live on a farm. You can't see anything that isn't nature. You would love it there. How come you don't invite me? I say. I am joking, but I see it's not funny to her. She is looking sad, so I shut up my big fat mouth. They eat chicken feet.
Like Chinese?
And chicken heads. By the plateful. Only heads and feet.
No body?
You can get a haircut on the truck.
What, you're kidding me?
On the back of a pickup truck. It's true.
You do that?
No, she laughs. I go to a Chinese lady who snacks on chicken feet. You have friends there? A lot of friends? Friends? She is looking at her hands, thinking a little bit, then raises up her shoulders. I know everyone, she says. She climbs into my hospital bed, crawls under all those fucking plastic tubes. She pushes the buttons to raise our heads, then our feet. Then she lowers the feet almost all the way. There. Isn't that comfortable? She says. We lie like that. And I fall asleep for a long time. I don't know how long, but when I wake up, the outside is dark. Lucia is still next to me, watching action thriller on TV. She points remote to turn it off. I want to say something, but I have to think before I say it. What is it? She says. Remember, a long time ago you say you come to visit? I waited. How come you never come? She doesn't answer me. She puts her head on my shoulder and I kiss it. I see there is some gray now, and the skin of her face, it's a little bit loose, with some lines around the eyes. I press them closed with my fingers. All those years you left your kids while you lived in New York, she says.
Yeah, sure, I say.
You were okay with that?
Sure. I went to New York to make good life.
They were with their mom. Kids should be with their mother. Johnny, always he loves his mother like crazy. She nods her head, rubs her eyes, blinks away the sleep. If I'd come, I never would have gone back, she says. She shows me pictures of her daughter. Esperanza. The name means hope. This is the first time I ever see pictures of her. So I see a lot. From time she is tiny baby to now. She has big open face with far apart eyes turning down at the corners like water drops. She is beautiful like you,
I say. When I meet Lucy, she's 28 years old. But when I remember her, she is without age. Someday I will tell her about you, she says.
What will you say?
I will tell her, love is everything. She looks at me, then down at her hands.
But now, like this, I think love is just a romantic way of explaining selflessness.
She sings to me. I close my eyes, and for a while she continues to sing. Ezekiel disconnected them dry bones. I think it is her. But maybe it's an angel. Who knows? I am having too much pain now. Too much fucking pain everywhere. They fill my plastic tubes with morphine. I can't hardly talk. I can't think. I say I can't do this. I don't want this. I say, Lucia, you have to let me go. She is so sad. I tell her you will go back to be with your family soon. Be happy. She shakes her head, making a breeze in the room with the way her hair whips around. She shakes and shakes it, harder and harder. Like she is trying to shake out everything inside. It makes me sad. So I close my eyes. This is life.
Chapter 10. Meyer, Minnesota. Most people of Meyer, Minnesota had never met her in person, but they saw the reports on the news. This was December, an early winter storm. The forecasters had touted it for a week as the next Armageddon, and the entire region had scrambled to prepare. They chopped extra firewood, drained their hoses, boarded barns, cleared gutters, salted driveways, filled tubs, dug out flashlights and emergency radios. Tommy Boyle, owner of Boyle Hardware and Lumber, said he couldn't remember the last time he'd witnessed such hysteria. The store had been cleaned out of batteries 72 hours before the first squall even hit. Zach Barnes, veteran fire chief, urged those using candles to exercise caution, recalling how the Dixon's place went up in flames just last year. This was what she was wearing. A pair of pink rubber rain boots. A flimsy polyester jacket with fake fur-lined hood. She was a Chinese girl from some hot-weather foreign country. She didn't know about snowstorms. At least, this was what they'd heard. She came to town to care for the one-armed man. The one from Israel. Sandy Alsop, hospice nurse, could attest to the girl's diligence, the tenderness with which she tucked the man's blanket around his feet, brought ice chips to his lips, gently lifted his head from his pillow as she mopped the back of his neck with a cool washcloth. The girl was devoted, Sandy said. Never flinched. She stayed right through to the end. They didn't know much about the man, either. He'd shown up one day, purchased a large parcel of land abutting Muir Lake, spent 2 years building a post and beam on top of the hill. They admired his house, its tall arched windows visible only in winter time, when the trees were bare, from the narrow path along the opposite side of the lake. Edie Blythe, ever the promptest widow, had brought the man hot dish after hot dish when he first arrived. He was a bit coarse, she thought, though he seemed well-built, polite enough, if a touch morose. She forgave his lack of interest. It was not uncommon for outsiders. The people of Meyer had their own ways of interpreting things. Donnie Dawes, college freshman dropout on a double shift at the Cub Foods, said he remembered seeing her that night. She had unusually dark eyes. Odd, because somehow they were also very bright. To his teenage mind, she could not be beautiful. She was beyond beautiful's age. But it registered as a prick of mortification, this older woman initiating arousal in his groin. She bought 2 sticks of butter. He remembered it, the 2 lonely sticks of butter, because he wasn't even working the express aisle, and it was way too crowded for that time of day, everyone stockpiling for the storm. He said it was her. She didn't look quite right. Sometimes people aren't quite right, and you can see it in their eyes. It was grief, some said. Clearly, the girl loved the man. She'd stayed on at the house to pack up his things, even after his 2 grown children had departed to bring their father's body back to Israel. Grief drives people to recklessness. Despair. 12-year-old Beth Grimstad wrote in her diary, "I bet it was a broken heart." They remembered when it happened to Natty Brown, whose wife of 31 years was struck by a logging truck while she was out for her morning walk with their corgis. 5 months later, they'd found Natty, naked from the waist down, handcuffed to a hickory tree. The coroner's report said he'd shed his clothes before he died, as freezing victims often do, this bizarre paroxysm occurring as the body's temperature drops below 85 degrees. A suicide note was found, fastened to the back of Natty's neck with a safety pin. That was gruesome, unforgettable, madness. It was a shame. On this they could all agree. She was young, no more than 35, no, 40, maybe 45. The police said they'd found nothing suspicious at the house. No evidence of foul play. A mixing bowl on the kitchen counter, along with flour, sugar, eggs, the 2 sticks of butter. Cookies? But it could have been muffins or waffles or pound cake or scones. It could have been many different things. She was all alone in that big house. But anyone can get disoriented, lost in the woods, caught in a bad place in a storm. The temperature's down to -7 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 below zero with the wind chill factor, gusts up to 70 miles per hour. 9 local fatalities had already been directly attributed to the storm. 5 elderly residents died when the ventilating units in their homes gave out. A father and his 10-year-old son died from carbon monoxide poisoning, fallen asleep in their car, overcome by fumes. A 32-year-old man was found frozen on the hood of a truck. Ms. Katie Delaney, beloved 24-year-old schoolteacher, was killed in a single vehicle accident, smashed into the concrete guardrail down by the reservoir, body catapulted to the road. A tow truck fished her car from the ice, its front end crushed like an accordion. It had happened to many of them, too. Out in the woods, caught in a storm while hiking or camping or skiing or biking or fishing or backcountry lovemaking, they were young once, too, headstrong and invincible. It was a light snow at first. They'd commented aloud on how pretty it was. And it wasn't so cold, not at first, though forecasters had warned temperatures would drop precipitously. Who would go out in a blizzard dressed like that? It was Sadie Dunkel, 9 years old, who called out to her grandfather, Hey, there's someone stuck in the tree.
The three Irish wolfhounds, cooped for 2 days, thrashed into the woods. Ward Dunkel, treading slowly, gritted his teeth each split second before the icy surface snapped under the weight of his snowshoe. It was the morning after the storm. The sun shone bright. The sky glowed a deep winter blue. He realized it now. That glint of pink he'd caught sight of earlier had been a rain boot poking out of a drift. He saw the two sugar maples loom ahead to his left. He knew the pair. Their broad trunks joined together at the base to form a perfect V. Now the snow was piled high, there was room enough for a body to rest between them, and the back of the head touched one trunk while the naked foot touched the other. In between, the body lay, curled like a shrimp, knees to chest, head to knees. So all he could see was the purple polyester jacket with its fake fur-lined hood. But he did not need to see the blue-gray face with its shock-stilled eyes and blue-gray lips to know who she was. Lucia. Lucia Bach. The tree trunks arched, tall and majestic like a grand sleigh bed, the bare branches a moody canopy. She looked peaceful there, curled in that spot, as if she'd squeezed herself into a place of safety. Only the unnatural position of her left arm, dangling stiffly, indicated she was not taking a nap. How long had it been since she'd invited the neighbors to the house for that awkward little party, served cake and tea, and asked after his granddaughter? "Don't look," he said. "Sadie, sweetheart, don't look. Run and catch up with the dogs." He touched the cheek with his palm. And it was not like skin or flesh or anything housing life. It was solid, stuck, like a block of ice, a leg of lamb in the freezer. Careless. People are careless. People are careless and they die. But it was impossible to know the truth of another's interior life. Wasn't it? They shook their heads, puffed a cigarette or adjusted their hearing aids, or clutched the edges of their leather armchairs with their fingers, watched televisions blare the news. Stefan was frying onions in the kitchen when Miranda set down the phone. He watched her face lock up, drain into blankness. "What is it, Schatzli?" he said. He dropped his spatula in the sink, switched off the stove. Her eyes so dark he could not see her pupils. "Manny." That was him. He hated when Manny called. It could only mean crisis, never anything good. "Miranda? Who was that?" She shook her head. "Was that Manny, just now?"
"No," she whispered. "It was the hospital."
"Oh, Christ. Not again." Fuck. Not again. It had been less than a month since she'd returned from that trip to Minnesota. Quiet, withdrawn. No fights, at least, was what she said. And he believed her. This was a purer sorrow. He'd mostly left her alone.
"Not again, Stefan."
"What?"
"She's dead. Lucia is dead."
"There was a storm. Her body was found frozen in the snow." What came first was not the fact of the body or the snow, or the speculations of how the body came to be in the snow, or how the body was found in the snow. That would come later. It was also not the sadness or numbness or grief or release. That would come later, too. When she slumped into his arms, face in his chest, already deep in a state of shock and dissociation, what came first was this.
"Manny? What will I tell Manny?"
And then, I should have gone to her after Yona died. She was in that big house all alone. And
the pills. She must have stopped taking her pills.
These thoughts would bob to the surface for years to come. The what-ifs, the whys, fueling her bleakest nightmares, unleashing the guilt and anger for all she had done or not done, or tried or not tried, or plain never understood. It would take its toll, test their marriage. The inexplicable eruptions, retreats, assignations of blame, minings of pasts and souls in one relentless search for meaning. Forgiveness, that would come much later. But what came next was this. She was brisk, efficient. She sat in her wicker rocker on the back porch, pried open her laptop, booked tickets, sent emails, called funeral homes. Stefan accompanied her to Minnesota. She squeezed shut her eyes for the entirety of their flights. He drove their rental car straight to the morgue. When the reporters descended, she shied away. He turned his back to the cameras, tried to shield her from their insistent probes. The body was cremated, the remains presented to them in a cheap wooden box. "Approved for air travel," said the funeral director with a tight-lipped smile.
"It's ugly. Oh, my God, it's so ugly."
The funeral director broadened his smile. They placed the box in the middle of the back seat. Stefan drove, and she glanced at it frequently.
"Miranda, which way now?"
"This way, that," Kurt, distracted. Until at last they reached the rough gravel road. The barrenness of the woods, maples and oaks. He could see the clearing now, the lake below, that vast stillness blanketed in snow. She did not want to enter the house. He had to go first, twist the icy doorknob. It clicked, giving way to the darkness inside. It was stuffy, sober. He could see boxes and bins. Yona's possessions arranged in neat piles. When he flicked on a light, she let out a small cry, muffled it quickly, her lips drawing into a tight, thin line. On the kitchen counter, a metal mixing bowl. Beside it, flour, sugar, butter, eggs. The police had not touched anything when they inspected the house. She rummaged through the cabinets, found a garbage bag, quickly disposed of it all. Ward Dunkel, the neighbor, came by to offer his condolences. He brought a loaf of currant bread.
"I saw the lights on," he said. "I live over there."
Through the tall arched windows across the lake, they could see a plume of smoke rising, that distant tendril of warmth. She made a pot of tea. They sat in the kitchen. Ward Dunkel explained about the dogs, about his granddaughter, the tree, the snow. Stefan watched Miranda's face grow hard, like the pain had frozen up inside her and all that was left was a layer of skin. And then she did not want to listen any more, and she stood, thanked the neighbor, said they really must get going. It was not their place, this house. This was Yona's house. They were staying at a nearby motel. They'd come to gather Lucia's things, that was all. Though perhaps Mr. Dunkel could help them lock up, look in on the place every so often. Shakily, she headed up the stairs. She disappeared for a while. When she returned, she carried her sister's clothes in two large plastic bags.
"Mr. Dunkel?" she said. "Is there a Salvation Army around here?"
She wanted to make a donation. Stefan buttoned his long wool overcoat, stepped out to the porch, a sharp bite in the mid-afternoon air. A squirrel scurried across the roof, Icicles hung from the gutters. The snow lay undisturbed. He popped the trunk of the rental car, set the clothing inside, paced up and down the driveway, hands in his pockets, striving for warmth, avoiding chit-chat with Ward Dunkel, who had wandered around to the side of the building to puff on a cigarette, the both of them waiting, waiting. She emerged from the house carrying only a few additional items. A canvas travel pouch, a small duffel bag, two medium-sized paintings, a globby brown duck and a yellow goose. Childish renderings, not hers, in primary colors. Stefan had not seen them before. She placed the canvases on the back seat of the car, propped them up so they flanked either side of the lonely wooden box. She stared, biting her lip.
"Mr. Dunkel," she called out. "Was it far from here?"
"Far?"
said Ward Dunkel. But her eyes stayed fixed on the wooden box, and Ward Dunkel understood.
"No, not far. About half a mile up the lake."
"Please, would you take me there?"
The snow was deep, the reflection bright. She raised one hand to shade her eyes, focused on lifting her feet. One step, then the next, through the forested white. Soon the house had disappeared. No discernible trail remained. Only the dark maze of trees, branches, the thick wintry bareness, and three sets of footprints, marking the direction from which they had come. Ward Dunkel chattered.
"Up this way, right through here. Not much farther now."
It was not a long walk, 20 minutes at most. But in a storm,
yes, one could get lost in these woods.
They climbed down a hill, rounded a bend, approached a clearing where thin purplish shadows crisscrossed their path. The sun, already low.
"There," said Ward Dunkel.
He pointed ahead to the tall pair of sugar maples, looming, stalwart, apart from the rest. Stefan could see her breath, quick and shallow. It condensed in the cold. Her comportment, stiff, unyielding. But he did not reach for her hand or place an arm around her shoulders or attempt words of comfort. He let her go alone. She walked up close, close enough to touch. She lingered there, examining those sugar maples. The immenseness of their trunks, each wider than her body, the way they joined to form a perfect V. She spread her arms like wings, arched her neck, tilted her chin to the sun. A gust of wind, a bird shuttled to air.
"The finches, they stick around some winters,"
Ward Dunkel said. She did not seem to hear. She turned in place, shuffling her boots, rotated her body, surveyed from low to high, to low again. And she continued to turn, turn, her gaze cast wide, until she had captured every detail of this scene in her mind. This chill, this hush, this illumined sky, this panorama, all 360 degrees. And a softening came to her eyes. She would tell Manny of that day when she met him 3 weeks later in Ecuador to deliver Lucia's ashes, bequeathing them to him in the middle of a noisy airport café. They would speak at first of other things. Esperanza, the weather, the abject ugliness of that cheap wooden box.
"At least it's travel safe," she said.
This was her bungling attempt at lightness, which he readily forgave.
"Like her giant plaid suitcase from Orchard Street," he said.
She would retrieve from her purse the small orange vial. Set it down on his side of the table. It rattled as he shook it in the light.
Was she taking them? Can you tell?
They engaged in conjecture, each trying clumsily to absolve the other of sins, the ones they were certain they themselves had committed. She did not tell him her composure was a gross facade, that she'd vomited on the flight, once during takeoff, again as the airplane had pulled into the gate. He did not tell her of his shame, that for years he'd been unfaithful, that he'd rushed to find Luna after receiving the news. In the end, they agreed. There should be no blame. Yet each would remain tortured in the years to come, unable to fend off their guilt. He invited her to the campo. She politely declined. She could not bear to face the scrutiny of a family of strangers. He did not press. He understood. This was a brief encounter, tender yet strained. They would part knowing what they'd always known, that they had each loved Lucia. And this was enough for now. Neither was ready for more. In grief, the future seems impossible. In the end, she would describe to him the best she could, that moment in Minnesota when everything else fell away. He listened closely. She watched his face as it crumpled. His body, too. Sagging as though the bones had collapsed inside. And with shocking force he would emit a long, bestial howl, shudder and sob, and gasp unabashedly for air. Raw pain squeezed into fat, dripping tears. And Miranda's would follow.
It was beautiful, Manny. It was beautiful there.
Part 4. Epilogue. Miranda.
She said she would come to our apartment at noon. And at noon I was out on the balcony, watering my zinnias, as I had been every few minutes for the past half hour, peering anxiously at the street down below. She'd arrived in the city 2 days before, insisted on making her own way to the NYU dorms.
She's stubborn,
Manny had warned. Independent. Like her mother. She was prompt.
Come on up,
I called through the intercom.
Fourth floor.
I buzzed her in. I listened to the click-clack of her heels as she climbed the marble staircase. She was wearing heels, so I figured she must be concerned with making a favorable impression, and I found this somewhat reassuring.
Dear Miranda, she said, slightly out of breath as she approached the wide-open door. It's me, Esperanza, your niece.
Esperanza, come in.
Welcome, darling, I said.
I kissed her cheek as we embraced. This was not a word in my day-to-day lexicon. Darling. But with her bright blue raincoat and patent leather Mary Janes, she seemed just that. Darling. Lucia's daughter.
Did you find your way? How was your trip? Are you tired? How was your dorm?
I asked, all at once. My niece and I had exchanged a few emails, spoken over video chat while she was submitting her college applications, but this was the extent of our communications.
It's fine, Tia, she said, laughing. Except I didn't like the airplane. It made me feel sick. I didn't like it at all.
We had that in common, at least. She was very beautiful. Exotic. Difficult to categorize. Just as she had been as a baby. A healthy light brown color. Luminous skin. Eerily dark teardrop eyes. And one would not be able to say with certainty whether she was of Chinese descent, or a Latina, or a Filipina, or even some kind of indigenous South American Indian. She glanced around the living room, commenting on how pretty everything was. The white linen curtains, my prolific jade plants, the view over Central Park. I asked her to please sit. And she did not choose the leather recliner or the plush red couch with matching red and white throw pillows, but chose instead the piano bench, which she pulled out a few inches until it was within arm's reach of the cheese and crackers I'd set on the coffee table. Do you know, the last time I saw you, you were only 4 months old, I said.
Yes, that's what Poppy said.
Her eyes, bright. Thank you for the books, Thea. All the English books. Of course. And how is your Poppy? He mentioned something about a painting business?
Yes, he's been talking about that, she said. But my Poppy, you know, he's usually kind of slow to move.
Tortoise. And Lucia, the hare.
But he's getting married this Christmas. Her name is Daniela.
Oh, I didn't know. I'll have to congratulate him, I said. Though Manny and I had been in contact these past few years, it was primarily with regard to Esperanza schooling. I would not say we were close. This was not the right word. But in our concern for Lucia, we'd shared an uncommon bond. And I now found myself teary-eyed. Moved. I thought, yes, how much he deserves this.
She's nice. She has three daughters, my new sisters. My Poppy is really happy.
That's wonderful, I said. And your Uncle Freddy, how is he?
Gordito's fine.
She blushed.
That's what we call him, Gordito.
I opened a box of chocolates, offered them to her. She selected an almond nougat.
My Poppy loves these, she said, grinning.
And then, out of nowhere, the most jarring non sequitur.
Thea, will you tell me about my mother?
I was taken aback, I admit, though her abruptness was tempered by her genuine manner, and I found myself admiring her straightforwardness. She wanted to know everything, of course. A young person wants to view a parent through another's eyes. All those years Lucia lived in South America, she had no past, no ties, no history, no other angle of light by which her daughter could perceive her. So I tried to tell my niece, from the beginning, how Lucia was, even as a child. Vibrant, vivacious, a free spirit who did as she liked while somehow remaining immensely likable. And how she and her father met, what little I knew, and how they lived north of the city, in one of the towns on the Hudson, until they moved to Ecuador. You don't remember anything about the States? I asked.
I was too young, she said. Well, maybe I remember a zoo. I think my mother took me to a zoo.
And then there was Lucia's illness, on which the doctors could never agree, whether it was schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or something on the spectrum in between. This ruthless illness which hijacks its young sufferers, evicts their souls while blinding them to any cognizance of their own malady. Oh, I could go on. I asked Esperanza if she knew anything about her mother's condition, and she said yes. Her Poppy had mentioned it, and she'd read about it on the internet. I did not probe about her life in Ecuador, though I was curious as to what kind of mother Lucia had been. Was she lax or strict? Engaged or removed? Did she and Manny argue all the time? Lucia was never a good fighter. Yona said she held too much inside, that this made her sick. But then, he never did understand her illness. My niece did not know about Yona, I realized, as we continued our conversation. How would she have known? She was 10 years old when her mother went to Minnesota. By then, Lucia and I had grown painfully distant. Estranged, ever since that night in Cuenca. But while our few days together with Yona failed to bring about any grand reconciliation, I now prefer to think of that time as a thaw. She had driven me to the airport. A quiet ride, but we listened to music. The Rolling Stones, sang together a few lines here and there. When it came time to part, we'd hugged at the curb. And I was not the only one fighting back tears. Take care of yourself, I said. And in that moment, those words meant no more, no less, only a simple